to ask everyone to shut your phones and your machines off. And there's no standing in here. So if you can't find a seat, there's some nice, well-dressed, courteous men that will help you find your seat. And that's pretty much the rules. And since we have a lot to say today, so on these bills, the first one's easy, but on the next two, we're going to have a lot of people testifying. Try your best to keep your testimony concise. And if you have 10 pages of written testimony, don't read it, because I will stop you, ask you to summarize. If you continue to read, I will stop you again and ask you to take your seat, because we haven't got time for that. And your written testimony is just as good as if you'd read it. It goes in the file, but try and be brief, because we want to give everyone a chance to talk today. So with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2223 and call Michael Wood.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2223 was pre-session filed on behalf of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It expands the definition of employer for the purposes of the Oregon Safe Employment Act to include successor employers. Under the current version of the measure, successor is defined as a business or enterprise that has substantially the same ownership and substantially the same kind of business or enterprise. And there is a -1 amendment before you that modifies the definition of a successor. There is no fiscal revenue on the original bill, and there's no fiscal on the -1 amendment.
All right, Mr. Wood, you want to go ahead then?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Michael Wood, and I am the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which we refer to as Oregon OSHA. I testified before you several weeks ago with regard to the substance of the bill. I indicated at that time that we were suggesting an amendment. The -1 amendment simply directs the department or forces the department into a situation where we would need to engage in rulemaking to provide more specific guidance with regard to the successorship before we could use the revised definition to hold an employer accountable.
Are there any questions for Mr. Wood? Representative Berger.
What was the problem with the original language in the bill?
Well, the original language in Chair Schaffler, Representative Berger, the original language in the bill was broad, and in further discussions with our stakeholders, they suggested that it was somewhat vague and probably too vague to be workable for employers in terms of understanding the guidance. So it was at their suggestion that we decided that providing the direction to provide more specific criteria in rulemaking would be appropriate.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My pleasure. Any further questions? All righty. Well, then, good job. I will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the -1 amendment to House Bill 2223.
Representative Hovey moves the -1 amendments in House Bill 2223. Is there discussion? Is there any objection? Without objection, so moved. Representative Hovey?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2223 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hovey moves House Bill 2223 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, seeing none, Kristen, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Representative
Berger. Aye.
Mr. Escobar.
Excused.
Mr. Hovey.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative
Mock. Excused.
Chair Schaffler.
Aye. Very good. Do we need to hear this on the floor, or can we put this on the consent calendar?
I would make a motion we put it on the consent calendar.
All right. Representative Smith moves we put House Bill 2223 on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2223.
Yeah, 2223.
Yeah.
Yes. Do you want me to put it in for a moment?
Pardon?
Yeah.
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2538.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2538 was brought to you by the Business and Labor Committee on behalf of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. It requires the State Landscape Contractors Board to establish a continuing education requirement for landscape contractors of up to 10 hours per year. It establishes the types of resources that can be used towards the requirements, such as attending classes, industry meetings, or trade shows. Under the measure, landscape contractors submitting applications to renew licenses expiring on or after January 1st, 2009, map to demonstrate compliance with the continuing education requirement. The measure also allows the board to establish waivers of up to 2 years for circumstances such as military duty or extreme hardship. There is an emergency clause on this measure effective on passage.
Very good. I'm going to call Mike Snyder with the Landscape Contractors Board. Is Mike here?
Is he out in the hall?
Here he comes. Perfect timing.
Grand entrance.
Man, like a bride. The door is open.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Forgive me. I'm going to close the work session, open a public hearing. Forgive me. Sit down, Mr. Snyder, and tell us what we're doing here.
Representative Schaffler and members of the committee, my name is Mike Snyder with the Landscape Contractors Board. This bill is not our bill. This was introduced by the Landscape Contractors Association, which is the association that has people become members of that association. This bill, what I understand, would require individual landscape contractors that have passed the exam to become a landscape contractor in the state of Oregon. In order to renew their license, would have to have a certain number of continued education hours to renew that license. The Landscape Contractors Board, on February 21st, at their regular board meeting, voted to support this legislation. I'm here to answer any questions you have about the bill.
Yeah, and forgive me, I was thinking of another bill and we're opening a work session. This is the first public hearing we had on this bill. Is anyone? Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you. Under this proposal, then it would be the board, however, that monitors compliance.
That is correct.
Is there any fiscal contemplated on this? More personnel? What does this mean for your board? It's the industry and association group that's proposing it, but it is your agency that will do the deed. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Representative Chair Schaffler, Representative Berger, you are correct. The agency would be held responsible to administer the program. The way the program is originally looked at in terms of when we started analyzing what we're going to do with this, there would be no additional staff required for the first couple years of this to audit those people that were doing the continuing education. We do have some fiscal impact in the terms of our database setting up a screen for that continuing education component to track those hours as they come into the agency. So I've talked to my staff and specifically about what we think this is going to be. The idea was that we would not be auditing everybody every year to do this. You know, it'd be a 3-year period, or we may do it every 4 years, take a quarter, random sample of a quarter of them, so that we just kind of see if we can get compliance in that manner rather than saying every time we do it. So it's kind of a program that we would do a random sampling to make sure compliance is being upheld.
Representative Berger.
And then who would monitor whether those classes are actually, they're learning anything, or whether they're just, and who's administering the classes, who's doing the classes, that kind of thing?
We would depend primarily upon the industry to do that. We'd ask them to submit their syllabus for the class to the board. The exam committee would review that. The board may allow the administrator to make that determination and give me that ability to do that. We see that many of the classes that would come in through suppliers, people that like United Pipe and Horizon and Verizon, the irrigation industry, they give lots of classes that are free, and they would just have to submit their syllabus to us to make sure that that's the criteria that we'd set up for them.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here to testify on this bill for us today and give us some clarity about what it does. I'm sort of curious, you had mentioned fiscal impact to the board or to your agency, and so I'm looking at, you know, how the Landscape Contractors Board has paid for itself, and I assume that's mostly through the fees that it charges its members. And so my question is, does the board intend on the fiscal impact of that will be produced by this bill to pay for it out of fees, basically, to the landscape contractors?
Chair Softer, Representative Holby. We don't see any increased revenue from this. The current, all the programs of the LCB are funded by the licensing fees and examination fees that we administer to the industry. We didn't see this as being a revenue source for us at all. We don't increase fees or anything like that. We felt that this would be a neutral thing for us in terms of revenue. We do see a little increase in spending to make it happen, but we have sufficient funds to do that. When we do a rule hearing on our budget, we would include that in our budget.
Follow up?
Senator.
Thank you. So just to clarify that the funds that you have available to run this program are coming from fees and not coming from the general fund.
Chair Schaffer, you're correct.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
How many members or licensees are there in your agency?
Chair Schaffer, Representative Berger. Currently we have over 1,200 individuals that are licensed with the Landscape Contractors Board.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could follow up, if they have to get training that they haven't had to have before, and you have to monitor it, and it costs your agency more money to do all this, the only source of that extra money would be increasing fees.
Representative Schaffer, St. Berger, that would be correct if we had to, if we had a negative impact on our budget, then we would have to review the fee structure. That's correct.
Thank you.
Any further questions of Mr. Snyder? Representative Smith.
I just have a quick question. Thank you, Chair.
That's fine.
Can you explain to me who this would pertain to? Because I'm not clear on, and it's because of an article I read in the Oregonian about somebody was doing landscape design and said no requirement was, no license was required. So I'm wondering who this would pertain to.
Representative Schaffer, Representative Smith. This bill only pertains to those individuals that have obtained a individual landscape contractor's license.
Okay.
Landscape designing in the state of Oregon is not regulated currently. It's regulated by default in the sense that if they cross over into the landscape architecture world, then they are okay. Regulated. Okay. But for landscape design, there is no regulation of that in the state of Oregon. So this only pertains to those individuals that have qualified to take the landscape contractor's exam,
okay.
Pass that exam, and then to maintain that license, they would have to have some continued education to demonstrate further competence in the field.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Any further questions of Mr. Smith? Representative Holt?
Sorry, just got to follow up on that.
Yeah.
Let me get this straight. You're saying that somebody could be out there contracting for landscape design services, yeah. And they're not required to be licensed under the Landscape Contractors Board?
Chair Schaffer, Representative Holvey. Good question. Currently, landscape design is a landscape architecture issue, really, okay, in the sense they are in the designing field. There's an exemption in the landscape architect's law that says if a person calls himself a landscape designer and does conceptual drawings only, in other words, they're not putting on the plan, construction details, or specifications,
okay.
Where they consider that's a health, welfare, safety issue, they don't put that on the design, then there's no license required for that to be done in the state of Oregon. Likewise, since our statute, ORS 671, has the word plan in it, that indicates that there's some designing issues for landscape contractors. So we have also allowed that exemption in our statute. We've followed the landscape architect's exemption, saying that if a person does conceptual drawings and doesn't put specifications on it, then there are no requirements for licensing.
Representative, follow up. So can this landscape design company or individual, can they actually perform landscaping work as a contractor?
Chair Shoffer, no. In order to perform the actual installation of the landscape, this, we're talking about the construction side, not the maintenance side. We're talking about the construction side. Install lawns, trees, shrubs, plants, irrigation systems, decks, fences, and things like that. They have to be licensed with the Landscape Contractors Board as a business to perform that work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Snyder, I'll ask you the question that I was going to say for the association, but you could probably give me some perspective from the board's standpoint. Anytime we're looking at any of these regulatory type issues, I always ask to myself, what is the problem that we're trying to solve with whatever we're doing here? What's the problem? Is it in the state's interest to be involved in the solution to that problem? And is this the right solution? And so could you speak to what is the problem from your perspective, from the board's perspective, what is the problem that that the association apparently is interested in addressing through this legislation?
Chair Software, Representative Edwards. To be quite transparent about this, is the board did want to introduce this bill before, you know, as a board bill. It was denied by the governor to do that. So the industry decided they would champion this bill. When the board was doing that, the examination for demonstrating competency to perform this work is a one-time examination. You come in and take the examination, and as you know, every examination doesn't guarantee competency. It assures or demonstrates at least a minimum level of knowledge about how to perform landscape work and to install these fairly elaborate landscape projects that happen today on multi-million-dollar homes and commercial projects. That competency, you know, is something that the industry is continually changing on. There's lots of issues around water, runoff, pesticide safety, installation techniques when you're putting in retaining walls, when you're building decks, when you're building fences, whatever you're doing. There are lots of competencies that are required for that. And the board felt that once you take that exam, that it behooves the licensee to demonstrate some learning in that area, in those areas again, as they continue to change. That you would better the profession, you would demonstrate that you had a growth element for yourself to become a better professional, and to lessen the claims that we would have because that competency would be further improved. So that was our purpose behind it. Because once you take an exam, if you'd have the license forever, it either needs to be re-examined again over a period of time, or you do it by continuing education. They chose the continued education route rather than retesting everybody every 5 years or something of that nature.
Any further questions? Oh, yes, sir.
So I've heard the theoretical. I mean, are we getting a lot of complaints? Is this? Are there a lot of people calling up the board every year saying, you know, this is really clearly a problem that's out of control? We've got a lot of landscapers, contractors running around that don't know what they're doing. I'm trying to move it beyond the theoretical and saying, I mean, is this actually a problem out there? And if it is, then...
Chair Schaffer, Representative Edwards. As far as our claim process is concerned, we only have about 7 claims a month coming to us from landscape work that's performed. Most of that work is not, most of that claim or the complaint that we have is not so much about they did a real crappy job. It's more about business practices in terms of how to communicate, how to write a good contract, how to follow up with their customer to make sure that things are done properly, the supervision part of that. That is our biggest complaint that we have coming to our board at this time.
I think I'm going to move on here, Mr. Snyder, because we're going to hear a lot of that, why we're doing this from the people that are for this, and some opposing, too. So they may answer some of our questions.
Understand.
For the sake of time, I think I'm going to move on here.
Thank you very much.
And we, just to leave the committee and everyone listening at ease, we will not be having a work session on this bill today. I misspoke. I'm just confused this bill with another bill. So I'm going to just start, and we'll save the end for the association representative if we need to clarify anything on this bill at the end of it.
Thank you very much.
And I'm going to go ahead with the first, with the people that are over 100 miles away, whether you're for or against. So I'm going to call Joe Limp, Bill Schumacher, and Patrick Griffiths, and then right after that, Bob Aitken, I believe. There's only room for three, but those are the four folks that have said they're more than 100 miles away. So come on up, and once again, try and keep it in 2 minutes. If you have written testimony, don't read 10 pages to us, because I'm not going to let you. But I think you all know what I'm looking for here. Just sit on down there in the front row there, sir, so you're ready to go. Go ahead.
Representative Schaffler and committee. My name is Joe Limp. I own Deschutes Environmental Services in Sun River. I serve as the Legislative Committee Chair for the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, and on its behalf, request your support of House Bill 2538. The legislation authorizes the Landscape Contractors Board to establish continuing education requirements for landscape contractors. Currently, once an individual has successfully passed the competency exam to become licensed with the LCB, there are no requirements for continuing education. The license is, in a sense, a lifetime license, even though the landscaping technology is constantly changing. House Bill 2538 would require landscape contractors to obtain up to 10 hours a year of continuing education through attendance in classes, industry meetings, trade shows, community colleges, and online education in an effort to increase their skills and knowledge. This has become an important issue to the landscape industry as it has transitioned over the past 15 years from a seasonal business to one that is now year-round. Skills and knowledge necessary to run a landscape contracting business are tenfold what they were. Individuals and companies that do not require ongoing education are a risk to the public and industry. The following topics are examples of education needs that are required now but weren't 15 years ago. Human resources. The laws and reporting requirements are much more stringent, plus the backbone of our industry is now Hispanic, with language and cultural issues that dramatically impact the workplace and the public. Safety. Changes in how the industry accomplishes tasks, new and more complex equipment, transportation challenges, and OSHA requirements, to name just a few. Water management. Our environment has changed dramatically, where conservation is almost mandatory, not to mention the continuing changes in water management technology. Proper ground preparation, knowledge of proper planting, enhanced irrigation systems, and so forth. Technology. Today, it is necessary for a landscape company to survive. It must embrace technology in order to be competitive. Those who do not become non-competitive and eventually have a substandard product or service. Environmental protection. It's absolutely necessary to know and understand and adhere to many rules governing the protection of the environment. Recently, stormwater management has become a big issue for landscape and irrigation contractors as more municipalities come under federal mandates to deal with this issue. Equipment. The sophistication of equipment, its maintenance, and proper operation are much more demanding. Chemicals. The proper use and non-use require regular continuing education. The public and the industry need to be proactive regarding education. Relying on a volunteer system for education does not serve either well. Requiring continuing education would benefit everyone. There are many other industries that already require continuing education and benefit from it. The Oregon Landscape Contractors Association believes that the landscape industry should be allowed to have this resource as well to keep pace with the changing world. Passage of House Bill 2538 would help enhance consumer and environmental protection. We urge your adoption.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, thank you, Chair Schaffler. Patrick Griffiths, I'm the Water Resources Coordinator from the City of Bend. I'm also a public member of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Board. I'm glad to see some familiar faces up there. I want to speak directly to Representative Edwards' question. Why are the water purveyors interested? Well, I sit in a lot of committees, as you do, and they talk about population forecasts of an additional million Oregonians by 2030. We have debates about future water supply concerns, water quality issues, stormwater, energy and related topics. All of these relate to House Bill 2538. Why? Because landscapes can use up to 60% of the annual water supply by municipal providers. Today, many landscapes require high inputs of water, energy, fertilizers, pesticides, and labor to thrive. This may not be sustainable in the long run as we try to plan for these new water supplies. New research into more sustainable landscape and irrigation technologies, practices, and related development strategies will go a long way towards reducing these inputs while retaining the beauty and livability that landscapes provide. Water purveyors, along with the Landscape Contractors Board and the industry, are standing by to offer the required education coursework in an easy and affordable manner. We anticipate subsidized education being offered through the water purveyor investment, which is already occurring within the implementation of our respective water management and conservation plans. As you may know, these plans are currently required in rule by the Oregon Water Resource Department as a condition of our water rights. I'm also carrying two letters of support today, one from the Central Oregon Cities Organization, who asked me to carry the letter to you today, as well as the Oregon Water Utilities Committee. This committee represents most of the largest and larger water providers in the state. This bill has spawned a lot of great discussion amongst water purveyors who are also dealing often with the stormwater issues, the runoff issues, the water supply issues, and all the things that we have to regulate as water purveyors, as well as the other sides of that, as many municipalities are dealing with these issues. The part of it that I think is really key here is this, to us, is a way to really offer support to the landscape professionals as key leaders and partners in cooperative solutions to these complex challenges. I want to offer you a few examples. One of the things we produced in Central Oregon was this Xeriscaping in the High Desert Guide. We made this a tool for licensed landscapers, complete with a spot on the back they could rubber stamp to give to their clientele, as a better way to change their practices than a regulation that a city or a water district may provide. We think education is the first step, and we think these guys are the key to changing practice. I also added in your handout to you guys a copy of this month's Central Oregon Community College's Irrigation Association's classes that we coordinated with the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association to be offered in Central Oregon, to help with this. The problem that we're having is not enough licensed landscapers are showing up. They're not attending. We're not getting the reach that we need to be effective in our conservation programs, in our stormwater programs. We need to bring everybody in. We need to have the same conversation with everybody. And then lastly, I think House Bill 2538 is really going to help enhance consumer environmental protection while giving the licensed landscapers an opportunity to better their business practices. We think there's a business opportunity here. We think this kind of education alternative is much better than some of the other regulations that other cities are doing across the West. So with that, I'll end my testimony and stand by for any questions you might have.
Is it Xeriscaping?
Xeriscape.
I got one of them when I was down in Bend this last
right.
interim. And if it, I'm not one of that 60%. If it doesn't survive with Mother Nature, give it on my yard, it's dead.
You do well with
that. Sir, go ahead.
Representative Schaffler, I'm Bill Schumacher, Springtime Landscape from Central Oregon. I've been a licensed landscape contractor for 26 years. That's back to 1980. And in these 26, 27 years, the industry has definitely changed a lot. I basically have self-taught myself by attending these classes, which would be the CEUs that would be approved for the licensing over the last 26 years. Not only have I been fined through OSHA for not following their safety rules because of basically ignorance, wearing safety vests on roadsides. A lot of this type of education, and it changes with, along with your laws every year, there's so much change going on, teaching and learning about the new safety laws, regulations in our industry is very important. The WaterWise program that Central Oregon and really the state is taking on, the proper use of water, not overwatering, it's all going to come through education. My wife's an ultrasound technician at St. Charles Hospital. They employ 2,500 people. They have CEUs. She goes to conferences for ultrasound technician. Electrician buddies of mine, they have CEUs, 12 hours a year for a supervisor, 10 hours a year for an apprentice. A lot of other industries have CEU, continuing education. I think it's going to better our industry. Landscaping is a fairly new and upcoming, in the last 25 years. We've gotten a bad name from a lot of clientele, possibly you, who said, hey, this guy didn't know what he was doing. He did a bad job. That's what this bill could help us prevent, is in better our industry, is keeping people who aren't interested in learning more about our industry out of the business, basically. So it's bettering our industry all the way around. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Do y'all have any questions for these gentlemen? All right. Thank you, guys. Have a good, safe trip home. Sir, you're 100 miles more away. Come on up. Get you going before the sun goes down.
I'm Bob Aiken from Sister Scapes Landscape in Central Oregon. I'm currently the president of the Central Oregon chapter of OLCA. I just basically reiterate what these gentlemen have said, that continuing education, it's required for several of our things like pesticides and irrigation auditors, so that any continuing education as a contractor with my employees and bills, and I think it behooves the whole industry to continue on with that. I also, in our OLCA system, we're going to try to implement further CEUs, maybe possibly helping generate more education and I guess you'd call it points for being an OLCA member. So I just would say that anytime you can continue education with employees and anyone in the industry, it would help.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I may have misunderstood you because I was reading and trying to hear you. You said that it's already required for something auditors?
Yeah, there's irrigation auditors. There's several requirements for other licensing that we have in our field. Like, you can become an irrigation auditor.
And
you have to maintain CEUs for that. And for pesticide licensing, and there's some other things that are driving that as well, which would
and those folks, if those folks then audit the irrigation system of a contractor or the pesticide.
No.
Who are those folks that are already?
I'm an IA, and it's a class that you take and you receive.
That it's required for whom?
Oh, if you're going to do that type of work, audit irrigation auditing and for commercial, and it's just a separate entity.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions for Mr. Aiken?
I just wanted to make a mention. It might help to not use acronyms.
Oh, it definitely
I
helps
don't
me.
Understand what
for all of you. CEU is Continuing Education Unit.
Okay. Yes. Okay.
Oregon Landscape Contractors Association.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, that's a message for all of us.
Well,
all right. Well, have a good day.
Okay, thank you.
And thanks for coming so far. I really, all of you that came so far, I appreciate that. All righty then. I'm going to call Wes Butler and Peter Padilla. Hope I said that right. Are you all out there? Wes Butler and Peter Padilla. Are you watching out there in the hallway?
No.
Here we come. Thank you. Great. Come on up, guys, and introduce yourself for the committee. Identify yourself, and just go right ahead. Whoever wants to go first.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Wes Butler from Silverton. I've been a landscape contractor for 27 years, and I'm not sure that qualifies me in this discussion, but I really don't have a lot to say other than many of the ideas that have been presented and many of the arguments that are in favor of this bill going through, I believe, can be accomplished through a private trade organization. And if we want to be professionals, I think we need to go do it without the state being involved in this. And that's quite simply my position on that, and I just want to share that with you.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Peter Padilla. I'm not a landscape contractor. I'm a landscape business owner, which means I have to employ a landscape contractor to run my business.
And, sir, if everyone on this committee is not aware of that by now,
I have not been listening.
And my personal kind of story is there before you. I won't share that at this point, only to say that last session, when this issue was brought up, it took the Senate committee to hear three of the seven or eight landscape contractors' testimony before they threw out the continuing education contractors portion of that bill. You can hopefully see what they saw, that the services that this serves, that there's no threat or benefit needful of legislation to the public. And this is just philosophically wrong to be looking at this issue as a matter of law, or even rules for that matter. Mike Snyder mentioned that the point to original test is to obtain a landscape contractor's license does not guarantee competency. Well, neither would ongoing education. The point has to fit. This is a would be a one size fits all type of issue in that it's a contractor that oversees the work we do, which is the niche area of hydroseeding. I ask you, you know, why does a contractor that oversees the mixing of water and mulch and seed and fertilizer and sprays it on the ground, requiring 10 hours of continued education every year? There's a list of things that the previous person supporting the bill as to why this bill was needed. In that ongoing education would be applied to. The problem is that if they're not required to take classes in those areas, then it doesn't. Then they've shot themselves in the foot as to, you know, all the reasons why they think ongoing education is needed. So they would have to, in all these areas that they see as high needs for ongoing education, they would have to require classes in all those things, and they're not even attempting to do this. This is an issue of, and I believe education is good. I've got a bachelor's degree in business administration, and my sons and I took classes just this January put on by Western Farm Supply regarding seed and application and stuff. I've got a small farming background and to know, you know, farmers in the areas who prepare the ground, who plant grass seed, and it grows, is ongoing education going after them next. This is a public issue that the association could take care of. Basically, if the public was aware that, and contractors, as you'll find out, are not against ongoing education. They do it themselves. And if the public is aware of that through an association, then the public can decide if that's the contractor they want to choose.
And maybe I'll talk to the proponents of this bill and figure out a way where that specific education specifically dealing with your niche in the industry would apply to your continuing ed hours. It's just a thought. Representative Berger.
Yeah, gentlemen, I'm asking you this, and maybe you're not the right ones to answer this, but in the previous testimony we had examples of classes from the community colleges, and the price of those classes is put in there. Has anybody or have you figured out how much it's going to cost you for the mandatory training in a year, and who's going to pay that other than your customers?
Representative Berger, probably my only comment to that, whether it's $5 or $5,000, the principle is not correct. And if private industry wants to go and become educated, become better businessmen, become professionals like we claim to be, then again, go and do that and perform in the free market and get a lot of customers because you're good at what you do. The bad guys are going to fall off if they can't get any customers. So I think the money is unimportant in this. I'm not willing to pay the I'm not willing to pay the $5 or the $5,000.
Representative Berger and Wes agrees. The money is important, and it's not as important to a company, a large company that's been established for a long time, has many employees, with maybe several, contractors. Mine is a father-son business, that employs this contractor that oversees this mixing. It's a big deal. And it's hard for us to get started, and they're wanting to squeeze us out of it.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know which one of you may want to answer this question, if I can come up with a question in the statement. But you made a statement earlier about, if the industry wants to educate themselves, they should go out and do it, and, the market will then determine whether they survive or not, and that there's really not an issue for the consumer here. And I kind of take exception to that because I think there is a big issue for the consumer here, quite frankly, especially when the landscape contractors are doing so many different facets where the consumer can be economically damaged. If you put the wrong fertilizer on my yard and I come home and not only are the dandelions dead, but everything else is dead too, or I know that landscape contractors, it was mentioned, they build decks and things like that, and decks have handrails and steps, and sometimes they're many feet off the ground. And if those aren't built properly, or you have the wrong spacing on your steps, you could cause somebody to fall and there create some liability issues. So I think there is a little bit of a consumer protection issues with many facets of landscape contracting. So. And I think education may not solve all of those problems, but in fact, at least it gets people pointed the right direction. Thank you.
Yes, sir. If you would like to respond to that, please feel free to.
Representative, only to point out that from Mr. Snyder's testimony is that there aren't ongoing complaints of that.
Thank you. If there's no further questions of these gentlemen, I'll call up some more folks. Yes. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
I'd like...
I got reprimanded here.
I'm just going to get rid of these two pages. So. Jameson Libari. Ulibari, I hope I'm saying that right. Forgive me if I'm not. And Jill Horninga, please. Jameson and... And Jill. Oh, no, I'm...
I'm you learning this.
I know.
We got one. No. I'm all for you. It's just, go ahead, please. Whoever wants to go first.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Jill Huyenga from the Eugene Water and Electric Board. I'm a water management specialist. I've been doing that job for 11 years for the utility. I do water conservation programming and backflow protection work for EWEB. I also, before I worked in that capacity, I've worked in landscape and landscape irrigation. I'm here specifically to speak to landscape and irrigation contractors in regard to water use in my municipality, because I thought it could be interesting to you to hear what the real impacts, fiscal impacts, on our water utility are. Landscape and irrigation contractors are water managers and our customer educators, the one that our customers listen the closest to. And they have a huge impact on our water utility operations and our capital planning. Other water managers in the state that are certified and licensed and also require CEUs are utility workers such as the water distribution folks and the water treatment folks, licensed plumbers, and backflow testers. However, landscape and irrigation contractors currently have the biggest impact on our water customers because of the nature of that demand on our water utility system. Professional training for irrigation professionals is readily available at low or subsidized cost. It's already strongly subsidized by EWEB. I'm sponsoring several folks, and I'm bringing and hosting an irrigation auditor training in a couple weeks. And you heard Patrick mention others. And therefore, the incremental costs to obtain CEUs would be minimal. And I'd like to speak to the if they had to raise the licensing fees incrementally, it would pale in comparison to the cost to our water customers for the impact of uneducated irrigation use. We did a case study. It started about 4 years ago. It was only 158 customers, and we were going to be forced to build infrastructure solely to meet irrigation demand. And we were able to avoid $500,000 of cost for 48 hours a year of irrigation use. Okay, that's Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 5 to 7 a.m., and we would have to build an extra $500,000 of infrastructure to meet that demand. We educated those customers, those few customers, and their contractors, and there were no cost alternatives to this infrastructure need. And that savings has been maintained over the last 4 years, and we don't see any change. And it was simply by learning about how to use the irrigation systems they already had installed. One of our engineers, actually several of our engineers, but I talked to the supervisor most, he's been really emphasizing that the same water use pattern that irrigation demand puts on our system is seen system-wide. And in order to meet that demand, in order to build infrastructure to meet that demand, we would have to spend millions of dollars. And he's asking me to educate our landscape contractors to do that, and I can't get anybody to show up. I go to where they are, and I'm meeting some lukewarm welcome in many cases. There's a few that are enthusiastic, and I applaud them for being good, forward-thinking businessmen, many of them affiliated with the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. So I urge you to pass this legislation requiring CEUs. These water managers are just as important as our water treatment, water distribution, licensed plumbers, and our backflow testers in helping us manage the costs and keep our infrastructure best used for optimum design parameters. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you for your time. I oppose the bill. I have...
Oh, excuse me, sir. You have to identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. My name is Jameson Uleberry. Mm-hmm. I own and run Sunlight Landscapes. I'm licensed with the Landscape Contractors Board. I've been... a businessman in the maintenance and landscaping industry for 14 years. I've been a licensed landscape contractor now for about 6.5. My business is built on education. but that's my choice. I stay small. I hire through a staffing agency, so they take care of the paperwork for me. I'm not big, but I'm competitive because I'm educated and because I educate myself. That's a market-driven issue to me. And I'm also sensitive to any regulation that would make it more difficult for the little guy to grow in business, because I've been the little guy, and it's hard enough to make a business succeed just with the market the way it is, just market forces. I think that's how business is supposed to be. I appreciate the need, as we just heard, for education, but I don't think it's government's role to require that. I don't think it will be helpful. It will squeeze out the little guy, make it more difficult for people to get into business, and that's part of what Oregon, what America is about. When I started, I borrowed a lawnmower. I borrowed a string trimmer. A friend gave me an old rust bucket pickup truck. So I started from the bottom and worked my way up, and I don't think we should raise obstacles that make it more difficult. I think part of the solution might be more in the consumer education. Consumers need to be educated so they can maybe more wisely choose the contractors that they hire.
Well, I'm a consumer, and for the life of me, unless I, someone else, or something's going to eat it, I ain't going to irrigate it. So then I just end up mowing it. Are there any questions for these folks today? And I don't want to minimize either one of your testimony. I'm just spewing out my own philosophy here.
Well, I think you would have enough sense that when you're talking, when you're getting bids from a contractor, you would hear what he has to say and you would make your decision based upon that.
Well, thank you for recognizing that. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'd like to call Judy Ranton, Mike Scroach, and Dave Sedlak. I hope I'm reading your names right here. Come on up and tell us what you think about this bill.
I take it you don't have a lawn.
Well, I have 2/3 of an acre. Yes, ma'am, go ahead.
Chair Schaffler and members of the committee, forgive my voice, but Mother Nature bringing on spring and my respiratory system are not agreeing with each other today. Mm-hmm. For the record, my name is Judy Ranton. I'm the Water Conservation Program Supervisor for the Portland Water Bureau. I've worked for the Bureau for over 20 years and have staffed the conservation program since 1991. Some of you may recall being in the Portland area in 1992. We had a short-term shortage. The city and the Water Bureau were authorized to identify and implement short-term water management strategies that heavily impacted landscape contractors at the time. Since then, we've been in dialogue with them, with the Regional Water Providers Consortium staff, which I'm also submitting a letter of support for, as well as my testimony. With landscape professionals, we provide education about the limitations that we have for providing peak season summer water, including finite storage limitations and treatment, limited distribution and transmission systems in some areas, and in-stream flows, as well as other issues. And we listen to their concerns relating to their customers' desires for green landscapes, the lack of incentives that we provide to reduce water use, and for some of them, a lack of knowledge about the best management practices and technologies that their own industry offers them. However, there are many as a result of these efforts, many of them have changed. Landscape practitioners that we've dealt with over the years have changed their practices, but there are many others out there who aren't as aware of the issues facing municipal water providers, and also those that don't understand their own technologies. And they manage, as some of the water providers out there have already told you, a significant amount of our summer water use. We believe that all stakeholders would agree that education about efficient ways to manage landscape water use is preferable to enforced curtailment during peak water season. And House Bill 2538 will make many more landscape professionals more aware of these water management methods, which will benefit the communities and water users throughout the state. For our part, Portland and the Regional Water Providers Consortium pledged to continue to offer no-cost education for landscape professionals and for end users. It's the end user who eventually will make the investment in ensuring that their landscapes are managed efficiently. We will also make attempts to continue to reach out to other professionals, the landscape and irrigation designers who are not regulated, and the maintenance professionals who aren't required to be certified, who also influence water management. So thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this House bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Go ahead, sir.
Yes, hi.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is David Sedlak. I'm a landscape architect and contractor, and I do oppose the bill. I sure appreciate all the concerns and the value for education. I myself am an educated person. I have 4 years of education, bachelor's degree, landscape architecture. I've passed licensing exams in Oregon, Idaho, and California, and I'm thankful and proud of those licenses I have, and I love my industry, and I love learning. It's my concern that the concerns that people are raising, it's being proposed that we take a fire hose to put out a candle. It's not. I don't mean to downplay the importance of the concerns, but I am trying to emphasize the method that is being approached to deal with them, that government has certain functions, and its function is not to try to regulate everything, and I just don't believe that that's the best thing to do in this particular case. Anyway, that's mostly what I want to say.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
My name is Mike Schrock. I own Living Color Landscape out of Aurora, Oregon, and I've been in the industry 18 years, and I strongly oppose this bill for many reasons. I think one of the biggest reasons is just that last month I sent one of my employees to an irrigation seminar, getting the kind of information that you were talking about, and it was a $600 seminar. It took 2 days. If this bill is passed, I would have to go to that seminar instead of my employee, because you see, I only have so much money available for education each year, and right now the way this law is written is that the licensee, which would be me, has to go take those classes. And so I don't need those classes, but my employee did. And I'm not against education. I just want the freedom to choose who I educate, because I'd rather give it to the person that needs it rather than to force it upon the licensee. And so that's one of the reasons that I oppose the bill. Another reason I oppose the bill is just that it's getting really hard out there. The economy's slowing down, especially in the housing market. And it seems like this, right at this time, there's like 7 bills connected specifically to landscaping. And every one of those bills comes with a price tag. It's not a lot. It's just one more little thing, another little thing, another little thing. And pretty soon you just go, I'm having a hard time surviving. I'm a company with 4 employees right now. During the summer, we'll go up to about 7 employees. And I've chosen to stay small. I was a company that had about 20 employees, and I've gotten smaller because, for me, I made a personal decision where I said I'd rather coach my son's basketball than to work all the time. But what's happening is every one of these new little regulations, let's just say we add 2 more days of continuing education, what's that do? It makes it so that I can't coach my kids Little League anymore. It's that type of thing. It's just a little bit more regulation here, a little bit more regulation there. And so it doesn't seem like a big deal to you all, but can you imagine if we just added 2 more days to your schedule of continuing education for you all? Well, that's kind of how I feel. I just feel like every time I'm turning around, they're adding something else onto me, and it's like, that's no big deal. You're a business owner. Business owners can eat that. Well, if I had 50 employees, I could eat that. If I had 50 employees, it wouldn't be a big deal for me just to take a day off. But when you have 4 of us working, and I have to stop and take 2 days of classes, what that means is that I've lost 1/4 of my workforce. And it also means that because I'm the guy that runs my crew, it means that the other 3 guys might get laid off for those 2 days. So there's implications to the entire company that I have. And so, anyways, this is one of those bills that it sounds really good in theory, but it's really going to hurt the little guys.
I think everyone up here has been a business owner one time or another. And I would agree that legislators need 2 days of continuing education a year. But one thing I want to actually, every day is an educating day for us. This is a public hearing, and it sounds like you're already doing this. So I suggest those that are against this to go to the proponents and figure out how we could use those days that you paid for that would apply to this, making you complying with it if this becomes the law. And every session there's a lot of bills about landscaping. Are there any questions or comments for these nice folks? If not, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'm going to call Corey Knutz, Matt Triplett, and John Stone, please.
Whoever sits down can go right ahead and go first.
Bill, we should.
We're ready to go.
Uh-oh.
There you go.
Chair Schaffler, committee, thank you for entertaining our comments this afternoon. My name is John Stone. I own a company called J.P. Stone Contractors. We're primarily in the Portland area. I'm the 2007 president of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. I just kind of want to reiterate what Joe Limp said earlier in his statement, that it's something that the organization has wanted for quite a while. We polled our members to verify that the membership wanted it. There was a strong response, and it was a strong positive response for the continuing education requirement. I did want to give you something to look at there to demonstrate the complexity of the work that many of us do and what causes us to want continuing education. Some of those are recent award-winning projects that different contractors around the state have done. And you can see you yourselves have mentioned a number of times today already the various types of tasks that we perform with ongoing changing technology. We need to do a lot to improve our competency. Thank you very much.
Sir, are you going to want these back?
Eventually.
Okay.
Thank you, Todd.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Matt. Chair Schaffler and members of the committee, my name is Matt Triplett. My comments will be very brief to avoid repetition. I am a licensed landscape contractor and the current chair of the Landscape Contractors Board, and my comments today are on its behalf. On February 21st, 2007, the board voted unanimously to support HB 2538, which would require individual landscape contractors to involve themselves in continued education to maintain their individual license. The board and agency stands ready, willing, and able to administer this program if the assembly decides to make this the law for the industry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sir, go ahead. Chair, thank you. Corey Knutes, licensed contractor, Valley Green Landscape. We're a small company, relatively. We have 9 people. This bill is being presented as perhaps the answer to all the problems in the way of education. Of course, I'm not against education, much like some of the previous contractors that came up here. It's out of my own selfish duty to educate myself and make sure I have an edge over the competition. And I do so, and I also send my employees to further educate ourselves. Now, the problem is these CEOs that we're talking about, Mike Snyder mentioned United Pipe. About a month ago, I took most all of my crew to John Deere Landscape University, which was would have been accredited CEO or CEU, sorry. But really what it was a sales pitch for blocks, pesticides. And now I'm not going to say I didn't learn anything, but in regards to some of the main concerns, a lot of the public water municipal people have been up here concerned about water usage and stuff, but that has nothing to do with the water usage necessarily. I mean, there's no guarantee. Yes, it is a cheap way for the LCB to present some kind of an education answer, but it's very diluted, and it's actually not that all CEUs would be that way, but I could have used that as a CEU credit. But does that answer the problem of contractor behavior out there on the job? Will this education bill guarantee contractor compliance, or will it even enhance it? Well, to what extent, I don't know. It seems very minor. But also Mike Snyder mentioned that there's no added expense to enacting this bill, but for the first 2 years, and then after that, what is the added expense? And then who's going to pay for that? Well, LCBs tends to run self-sufficient, sounds like. But that means if there is that expense, that's going to be me paying for it. And being a small businessman, of course, how enticing does that sound? Let's see. I don't know. It just doesn't seem like a legitimate way to answer the problems. It's just another example of government just expanding itself just a little bit. And it puts, and it also causes a great expense for me as a contractor, as a business owner. If I have to take my guys in, now granted I'm already doing that, but if I'm required to, what if I skip a year? Well, my lost wages per foreman is an impact of several days' labor, 10 hours. You know. I have to make up for that somewhere. But it is my best interest, I'll say this again, to educate my people anyhow, and myself, so I am competitive and I do get contracts. I just don't see this bill as being a way that's going to accomplish that in any efficient way whatsoever. Thank you.
Any questions for these gentlemen? All righty then. Thanks, guys. This is a public hearing. Would anyone else like to testify to House Bill 2538 today? Come on up, sir. Just sit on down and identify yourself for the record. And
I'm Daniel Mims. I'm a landscape maintenance guy looking to be a licensed landscape contractor shortly. I wasn't going to say anything today. I came with friends mainly just to watch the process and took the day off work to see how everything was done. However, after listening to everything said, I felt like no one's really speaking for me, which I'm at the bottom of the barrel of the landscape industry. I'm 3 years started. I'm operating under the guidelines of the LCB with Mike Snyder's help. They have a requirement that says you have to run a company like mine for 4 years before you can even apply to put in a lawn, to plant a shrub, to do anything. And so that leaves me, you know, mowing lawns, trying to get by until I can even meet the requirements to even go and take the test or take any kind of education. And that's fine, you know. I mean, it makes me feel like someone's got their thumb on me trying to keep me down, but, you know, I understand that. That's the rules, so I operate under that. But I really feel like that this committee is not hearing the whole story as far as when the tires hit the pavement. I feel like that what's really going to happen with this is that the big landscape companies are going to say, okay, all the little guys, none of you guys can do anything. And this is kind of what the LCB in itself has done. You know, not Mike Snyder notwithstanding, I like him a lot, but it's kind of what the LCB has done, and I feel like that this is going to do the same thing. It's going to keep the little guy out. And what the big companies are going to do is not say, okay, well, now we can rise to the occasion and be just the best little angels we can be. What they're going to say now is, now we can bid whatever we want, only we can do it. We can still do a crappy job and cut corners and do a horrible landscape job, a horrible design, horrible installation. And what's going to happen is companies like me, who really do care, whose my name is on it, we're going to come in and we're going to fix their jobs. And that's what we do all the time. You know, I mean, I'm sorry for the customers that are having to pay for things when they're wrong and when they mess up and everything, but the fact of the matter is that that's just going to happen. And you can try to micromanage every little company and every little thing, but you know what? Corey, the guy that just spoke, I know him. He helped me get started. He gave me my first weed eater to start and everything. And I mean, people go with him because they see his work. They see what he does. He has a reputation, and that's why he gets the contracts. And the bad companies, I won't mention them, that are in McMinnville, they don't get the work because they don't get the work because they do bad work, and they, you know, and those are the people that Mike Snyder's calling, you know. And like, all I see is all the little guys that, by the way, the little guys right now, they're out mowing their lawns right now. They're not in here because me, I lost a full day work to come in here. You know, but the little guys, the guys that are really going to be affected by this, they're not here. They're out working. These guys that are here with their big companies and their big contracts wanting to micromanage everything and get everything all situated the way they want it, they're the guys that are here. Their companies are still making money. They're out trying to make more money by keeping me and all my little compadres down, you know. And so, I mean, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, I'll wrap it up real quick. I know y'all are busy people, but I guess just the closing point that I want to make is that, like, in school, I always learned that government was for the people, you know, and, like, through my life, I've kind of been disillusioned here and there about government and everything like that, but I still kind of believe that its main function is for the people. But I think that if y'all pass this bill and even keep the LCB around, period, to just to satisfy the big guys that are here in their suits with their things like that, that you're not working for the people. You're only working for the small percentage that stand to benefit from this law and everything that's going on.
Well, Mr. Mintz, just so you know, I didn't always walk around in a monkey suit. I was in the labor's union for 8 years, rank and file, building America when I moved to Oregon. And in the evenings and in the weekends and when I was laid off, I, too, had a lawn maintenance business for 5 years. So I know exactly what you're doing. And I started with an old crappy pickup truck and a 3-horsepower snapper that someone gave me and a rake. So I know, and I ended up having more work than I could shake a stick at.
Yep.
And on days like this, it looks real inviting. So don't think for 1 second that this committee's here for just the big guy. That you would be wrong.
And well, I'm just,
any questions for this fine gentleman here? All right, I really appreciate it, though. Thanks for taking the day off and coming on down.
And Mr. Chair, you gave all that up to be a politician.
That's right, to wear a monkey suit every day. All righty then. Anyone else today? Okay, these are the last two. Then we're move three, and we're moving on. Come on up. Go ahead, sir. Identify yourself for the record. And
thank you. Jeff Stevenson. I have a company called JSI Landscapes, operating in Portland, Oregon. I'm a small company. I started in 1993 with a Nissan pickup, about $5,000, and a couple of guys I'd met to help me out. Prior to that, I'd worked with my brother, did maintenance, educated myself so I could get my contractor's license. Since then, I now have a national certification as a certified landscape professional. I have a degree from Oregon State in business, started off in hotel restaurant management, shifted gears, waited tables and bartended at night, did landscape by day. I currently have 5 employees, and they're not working today, and I'm totally in support of this bill because we're talking about 1,200 people in the state of Oregon that are required to have a license to be able to perform landscape and to oversee their employees. I educate my employees, but if I don't educate myself, how is that going to help? There was a reason for having a licensing procedure, which I agree with, but as everyone has already stated, there's a huge amount of things going on with people that have a landscape contractor's license. 1,200 people in the state are licensed to install landscapes. The rule says they have to supervise their employees. I think that's very minimal to ask 1,200 people to spend 10 hours a year to learn something. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir, go ahead.
Kevin Schindler with Autumn Leaf Landscaping. I just want the committee to understand that I also am a very small landscaper, and not all small landscapers are opposed to this measure. I have 5 employees. I felt it was important to enough for me to take time out of my day to come up here, and this requiring education is actually beneficial for the small guy. That's how I learned to be a better landscaper. I didn't start in the industry, and that's a big benefit for someone that's starting a new business to learn from others how to become a better business and grow your business and do it properly and not take shortcuts, figure out what new technology is out there. And so I believe it's beneficial for all landscapers, not just the big guys. And there is education out there that is very low cost or no cost, and so I don't see that as a financial restriction as well.
Thank you, sir. Yes, sir, go ahead.
I'm Rick Martinson with Winter Creek Restoration over in Bend. I also have a very small company. We have 7 employees. Our focus is ecology-based landscaping. We only work with native plants and low water use. I work a lot with Patrick and with the state and various municipalities. I think education is critical for the industry. I think we need to raise the standard of the industry. I have 12 years at Oregon State and various background all over the place. Got into landscaping about 7 years ago, and my emphasis is educating my employees and everything. And what you've heard today also is that is a lot of what's going on currently in the industry. I'm also involved with Oregon State, University of Oregon, in developing some curriculum in the future of landscaping in the state of Oregon. And that's both universities are beginning programs in ecology-based landscaping. I've been teaching seminars to their grad students and some of their faculty. And that's where the industry is going. And currently, people don't have a clue what that's about. And I think with the continuing education requirement that is in front of you now, that I think it's important that people get educated in where the industry is going. I'm in strong support of this bill.
Thank you. Any questions for these gentlemen? Very good. Thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate it. And there will be another public hearing on this again, I'm sure, before we have a work session. So if anyone didn't get a chance today, you will have another opportunity. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2538 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2754.
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members. House Bill 2734 establishes requirements that a school district must meet before entering into a personal services contract customarily performed by classified employees. It requires a school district to demonstrate that the contract will result in an actual cost savings and cannot approve a contract solely on the basis that the contract will result in lower contractor pay rates or benefits. The measure provides exceptions to these provisions, such as when contracted services cannot be performed by existing school staff, and the measure applies to newly renewed or entered contracts on or after January
1st, 2008. Very good.
Do you
want to
do...
She's in course of Ed.
Yes.
You just
Cancel,
Mr. Chair,
before
you
begin. Oh,
excuse me.
Mr. Chair.
Let me close the public hearing for just a moment.
Go ahead.
Chair, Representative.
I'd like to move that we suspend the rules and allow Representative Rosenbaum to cast a vote on House Bill 2223.
Representative Hovey moves we suspend the rules so that Representative Rosenbaum can vote on House Bill 2223. Is there any objection? Seeing none. Representative Rosenbaum, how do you vote?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I vote aye.
All right. Representative Rosenbaum votes aye on House Bill 2223. Did I need to?
Yeah.
That's an implied we opened up a public hearing on that. Do I need to open it up and have a vote again?
No.
We suspend the rules. It's fine.
Very good. All right. That's right. We can do anything well. We don't have the rules. I'm going to reopen my public hearing on House Bill 2754, and I'm going to call, is it Melanie?
Merlin?
Ms. Martin. Let me just get that squared away. And Gordon Lafer and Victor Mutual, please. That's what my good administrator told me. Those were the first people to come up. So is that wrong?
Yes, that's right.
Well, that's who's coming up now, I guess. Come on up. Okay. All right. Let me go ahead, Ms. Guest. You can go first, and then we'll call the rest of the people up next.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Marianne Guest, representing the Oregon School Employees Association. We represent over 20,000 educational professionals in the state of Oregon, and many of which are here today visiting. Some were here. They've left now, which is unfortunate, but a lot of people who care about kids and education. So I'd like to introduce Merlene Martin, who is OSCA's president, and she'll do a quick overview, and then I'll walk through the bill, and Victor Musil will give you some examples. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the House Business and Labor Committee, my name is Merlene Martin, and I'm the state president of the Oregon School Employees Association. What is that grimace? Merlene.
No, I got your name now. Merlene, that's all. Sorry if I butchered it.
I didn't have 10. I had 1, and now I've cut it down to a half, just letting
you
know. Okay. So if there's anything missing, it's because I had to cut it down.
Doing a fine job.
The OSCA represents 20,000 members who work in Oregon schools, their community colleges, their education service districts, parks and recreations and library districts, and Head Starts. The vast majority of our members are classified educational staff. On behalf of the membership, I want to thank you for scheduling this hearing on House Bill 2754. The issue of contracting out is not new to our union or to our members. Thousands of our members, over our 69-year history, have had to fight to keep their jobs from being contracted out. We have won many of those fights, and unfortunately, we have lost some. In each of those campaigns, districts have always used cost savings as their excuse and their reasoning for pursuing the outsourcing of our members' jobs. In speaking in support of House Bill 2754, I want to convey to the committee that this legislation is very important to our members. In communities throughout the state, there are thousands of our members who have spent their lifetime in the same community, graduated from the local high school, sent their children to the same school that they attended, and as a career have chosen to work in the local school district. It's these Oregonians and all others who work in our schools that deserve to have claims of cost savings thoroughly and honestly documented before their livelihood is stripped away by contracting out. I urge this committee to support House Bill 2754. Thank you.
Thank you, Marlene. Go ahead, sir.
Chairman Schaffler, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Victor Musial. I'm the Director of Field Operations for Oregon School Employees Association. In my capacity, I supervise 18 labor relations professionals who provide services to our members across the state under the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act. Another function that they're engaged with is trying to protect the jobs of these school employees. And quite often when we hear a school district that's interested in privatizing, the main concern is that it's a cost savings and they're going to save money. And who doesn't want to save money and put more in the classroom? As a parent, you'd think, great idea. Taxpayer, great idea. But the devil's in the details of those cost savings. And you're going to hear other testimony today about those details and exactly how much money is or isn't being saved. But there are other reasons that we know about when school districts want to go and privatize part of their services. Transportation, namely, being the top one. 2 years ago, in Central Oregon, in Jefferson County School District in Madras, they had problems within the transportation department among the members and with management and new management in there not being able to deal with them. There were issues of cronyism, favoritism, fear of discipline, and the administration and the school board just kind of threw up their hands and said, we don't want to have this problem anymore, so we're going to issue an RFP. Well, one of the services we provide our members is mediation services. We have trained, accredited staff members who are skilled in mediation. We identified that problem, that it wasn't a cost issue. It was one where management just didn't want to deal with a problem and let somebody else deal with their problem. We went in there, identified it, carried on a successful mediation process, then worked with administration, identified the problems, and started working collaboratively together to solve those issues. And in their June board meeting, those members showed up, and the school board in Jefferson County tabled the matter, and it hasn't surfaced since because we worked together and solved the problem. Last year in Astoria, much the same situation, and we worked with the administration and the members of the transportation department together to solve those issues because they weren't cost-driven. It was just, we want to get rid of a problem. The one sad example I can share with you is in Northlake School District, a small school district, had 5 bus drivers. One of them was the chapter president. They didn't want the union there, quite frankly, to be honest with you. And they decided to privatize the services of transportation in Northlake County, Northlake School District. We examined their budget documents and determined and showed them where, in that small school district of 200 children, it was going to cost them an additional $33,000 a year to provide contracted bus service. They agreed and accepted that figure. And despite that, privatized. Our predictions were off by a few thousand dollars. It cost a few thousand over $33,000 to provide transportation services to the children of Northlake School District, some of which had to have their parents drive them 30 minutes to the bus stop so they could catch a 1-hour bus ride to school. That's how spread out that district is. And then in the middle of the contract, the contractor determines we're no longer going to provide midday kindergarten runs. So kindergartners were stuck there all day. Now, it's our passion, and we believe earnestly that the interests of the public, the interests of the schools,
and the interests of the children are best served when classified employee work is performed by classified employees who are employed by the school district as opposed to a privatized contractor who is in it for profit. And there is more genuine concern and caring, we believe, among public school employees employed by school districts. Now, that's not to say that some privatized workers in the public school system don't. I know many of them. As a matter of fact, we represent some of them, too. But it comes at a cost. It comes at a cost in quality of service and delivery to the school district and to the employees who suffer at this. So I'm here urging your support for House Bill 2754. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, I'm Marianne Guest representing Oregon School Employees Association. We have some people here from California and from Eugene, and so you have my testimony, which actually walks through the bill. So if I may yield my time to the people that have come from out of town.
Yeah, we had people in the last bill over 100 miles away, yeah. Too, so I just went in order. Who's from California? Just you name them so I can call them up. Are they on the list here?
Yes.
Lokia Smith.
Right.
Okay, Lokia Smith. And who else?
Then I would like the opportunity to have the folks that came from LURC speak.
Okay, I need their names.
Okay, it's Gordon. They're on the list.
Gordon Lafer.
Right, and Bob.
And Lokia Smith. Okay. And who else is from out of town?
And Bob.
And Bob Russell. Will you all three come on up here, please?
Yeah, I'll yield my time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's Bussell, not Russell.
Excuse me, Bussell. Bussell. I thought that sounded familiar. So Bob Russell, Gordon Lafer, and Lukia Smith. Come on up.
Bussell.
Bussell, I did it again. Gosh almighty.
If you're calling Rob Bussell.
Go ahead, sir.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Gordon Lafer. I'm a professor at the University of Oregon's Labor Education and Research Center. And over the past 4 years, I've been conducting research on the economics of contracting out of school services in Oregon school districts. The results of that research are disturbing in a number of ways. Every case of privatization that we've looked at, the promise is the contractors will deliver the same quality of services at a steep discount, resulting in a big savings to the public. I have never found this to be the case in any of the cases that we've examined. Let me say one word about quality, and then I want to move on to talk about the money. Every case that I've examined, the quality of services is significantly lower after privatization for the simple reason that privatization in every case has been coupled with a major slashing of wages and benefits, which results in a workforce that is less trained, less educated, lower quality, and much higher turnover than when the same work is done in-house. So that we're not comparing apples and oranges, we're talking about a lower quality of service that comes with this. But what I really want to talk about today is the economics of this and the cost-benefit analysis. In every case that I've looked at, the actual savings from privatization have been significantly less than that promised by the contractors, and in some cases, when all the costs are added up, it actually turned out to be a net financial loss. I want to explain to you what some of those problems look like by talking about just one of those cases, which is the Lake Oswego School District's decision to contract out school transportation. Lake Oswego contracted out transportation in 2003, and at the time, what was declared was that this would result in a savings of $1 million over a five-year period. What it looks like instead is a net loss of several hundred thousand dollars instead of a net gain of $1 million, and I want to explain the main reasons why that happened. Some of it involves the shifting of costs from what previously would be borne by the district or the contractors to the state. One way that happened in Lake Oswego is what seems to me a kind of unusual loan from the contractor to the district. And you have this written up, but it took me a long time to figure out the details, so I'll try to explain it in a very straightforward way. Lake Oswego said that whoever bid to operate its bus services would have to buy the existing fleet for $1 million. Laidlaw Transit, a multinational company, won the bid. They said the bus fleet's only worth $650,000. So the agreement was that Laidlaw would buy the fleet for $1 million, but that the district would have to repay the difference with interest over the course of a five-year contract. The difference was $350,000. It became $400,000 with interest. The district said, okay, we'll repay that $80,000 a year for 5 years. At this point, it seems just like a loan from Laidlaw to the district that gets repaid over 5 years. But the district submitted that $80,000 a year to the state as a transportation expense. The state reimburses 70% of all transportation expenses. So what really happened is that Laidlaw gave Lake Oswego $400,000, the district repaid $120,000, and the taxpayers of the state repaid the other $280,000. Now, in the cost-benefit analysis, when they said we're going to save $1 million, part of that was based on treating the money that came from the state as if it was free money that came from nowhere. But when we do a real cost-benefit analysis that takes into account the, you know, all of the costs, we need to include that $280,000, and that significantly lessens the savings. I don't want to speak for the Department of Education, but my understanding, based on communication to me from the Department of Education, is that this transaction is a violation of state regulation. However, the Department of Education does not have the staff to examine the details of every contract of every school district, which I think points also to the public policy reason for the bill that you're considering, which is to say there needs to be some kind of due diligence process or some kind of screen at the level of the district, because we're not, unless the other choice is to have an enormous bureaucracy at the level of the Department of Education to police all of these contracts. So that was the first problem at Lake Oswego. I want to describe to you just one other problem, which is much more common, that I know have documented happened in the Rainier District, but I believe happens in many districts, which is that public money is used to purchase buses that are owned exclusively by private contractors. In Lake Oswego's five-year contract with Laidlaw, it says that 28 new buses will be purchased over those 5 years. Now, under state regulation, the state reimburses districts for the purchase of buses when they are the district's property, not when they're owned by a contractor. But the cost of those 28 new buses was folded into the per mile or per hour charges that Laidlaw submitted to the district, and the district in turn submitted to the state and got reimbursed at a 70% rate. So the state is paying 70% of that cost, and the district the other 30% for these buses. These buses are not the property of the district. They are the sole exclusive private property of Laidlaw. If the contract is canceled the next day, Laidlaw continues to own them forever. And furthermore, Laidlaw is free to use those buses for any commercial business purposes outside the school district whenever it wants, transporting people to weekend football games or concerts or sporting events or casinos, whatever it wants to do. Those buses can be used for any commercial purpose, even though they are bought by the taxpayers. One of the things we see in this contract that makes this even worse, and that is also common, is that contractors push for buying many, many more buses than the district would have bought on its own. In Lake Oswego's case, they bought 28 buses over a five-year period. In the previous five-year period, Lake Oswego bought 7 buses, which means the decision to contract out resulted in a 400% increase in the rate of new bus purchases. This is essentially because by the private industry standards say that a gasoline-powered bus after 12 years needs to be replaced. The state of Oregon has extremely rigorous standards on both on emissions and on the quality safety standards that buses have to be inspected every year, but essentially as long as the buses meet those standards, they can continue on the road as long as they're in good working order. Lake Oswego had quite a number of buses that were between 12 and 20 years old, and when they initially issued their request for proposals, they said the contractors need to recognize that buses have a longer useful life in the school system than they do in private industry, and the contract needs to be based on that recognition. But Laidlaw and the other two companies that bid on this lobbied the school district and got them to change their RFP. They issued amended language that said the buses must all meet industry standards, which means anything older than 12 years was considered useless and had to be replaced. So because of that, in response to industry lobbying, the district is buying 28 buses instead of 7. Maybe it would have bought 10 if it was an unusually high year, but a greatly accelerated rate of purchase of buses with public money that become the private property of these contractors. When the district said it will save $1 million by privatization, it was based on the assumption that the same number of buses would be bought whether it was privatized or remained in the district. But this is clearly false. And if we make a more realistic assumption that if it had stayed in-house, they would have continued replacing buses at more or less the same rate as in the past or slightly accelerated, it becomes clear that the decision to contract out resulted in a net loss of several $100,000 rather than a net gain. Let me just say one final thing on the Lake Oswego case. You might think, as I initially thought, okay, Laidlaw says we need all new buses in this five-year contract, that when the contract comes up for renewal in the second for the second 5 years, they won't need so many new buses. But the problem is, once a school district gets rid of its bus fleet, it is completely at the mercy of contractors. It has no negotiating leverage because it can't afford to take busing back in-house. When I talked to the business manager from the Lake Oswego District and I said, you're coming up to 2008, you're going to renegotiate this contract, do you expect that there will be many fewer buses purchased in the second 5 years? He said no, because Laidlaw knows what our options are. Our options are to do what they want or to go to one of the other two major bus contractors in the state, all of whom will require that we buy 28 or whatever, some high number of new buses. So the district essentially is over a barrel, and this is an additional cost that is not evident in the first year of the contract, but comes down the road, meaning forever after, the district is at the mercy of contractors, and it's easy to understand from the contractor's point of view why they want a whole lot of new buses bought all the time, particularly given that they're allowed to use them for commercial purposes, not to do with the school district, which also, by my understanding, in communication from the Department of Education is a violation of state regulations, but one that the Department of Education does not have the staff to police. So in all these cases, you know, what we see is both that there needs to be some kind of screen and process at the district level because the Department of Education can't police it, and that in fact what is presented to the public and to members of the school board as a large net savings can easily turn into a large net loss, a significant net loss. Let me just say in closing, Professor Bob Bussell and I have issued a report on this several years ago. We're in the process of coming out with another report. Although the cases I presented you today was just Lake Oswego Transportation, I want to be clear that the problems, we have discovered equally troubling problems in other districts in the state and in food and custodial services as well in bus transportation. It's not limited to this case of Lake Oswego. Thank you again for the invitation to be here. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Go ahead, sir.
Chair Schaffler and members of the committee, my name is Bob Bussell. I'm an associate professor at the University of Oregon and director of the university's Labor Education Research Center. And along with my colleague Gordon Lafer, I've spent part of the last 4 years studying contracting out of school support services in Oregon. And the particular piece of these reports that I've dealt with has to do with the impact of contracting out on workers, families, and communities. And I want to give you a brief overview of some of those findings here today. School districts that contract out support services clearly expect to save money based on reduced labor costs. As the Lake Oswego school superintendent asserted during his district's 2003 debate on contracting out, the reason the contractor can provide transportation services for reduced cost is because they do not offer a similar, comparable wage benefits package. As far as wages, contractors tend to grandfather incumbent employees that elect to work for them, but this is not always the case. For example, in the Pleasant Hill School District, workers who opted to remain with the private contractor found their wages cut by nearly 40%. In Lincoln County, the average wage for regular custodians under its first contractor fell by 24% and by 11% for head custodians. Wages for new hires are particularly affected. For example, bus drivers in Lake Oswego as new hires earned 15% less than they would have if they had been employed up by the school district. And also, those workers that have find jobs outside the school district, and many of them, they don't elect to work for the private contractor, but go to work in other enterprises and businesses, most of them suffer wage losses totaling from 8 to 25%. According to our figures. Clearly, when support services are contracted out, workers tend to experience some level of wage loss or wage stagnation. It is in the area of employee benefits where the savings for contractors are most pronounced and worker standard of living is particularly affected. All the school districts we studied had collectively bargained health care benefits that included comprehensive health insurance coverage. In contrast, under contractors, the health care benefits provided by the private contractors are much less generous. For example, in Lincoln County, premiums for family health coverage are fully paid under the collective bargaining agreement. However, full-time workers employed by the district's private transportation contractor pay over $6,000 annually in premiums for employee spouse coverage and over $9,800 annually for family coverage if they elect to take this coverage. Deductibles and out-of-pocket costs also tend to be much higher under the insurance offered by private contractors. For example, the plan I just mentioned in Lincoln County requires a $3,000 deductible for a family of three before coverage kicks in. Workers we interviewed also cited paying much higher out-of-pocket costs under the plans offered by contractors than they were employed by the school district, especially for prescription drugs. Also, as far as retirement benefits, the benefits offered by private contractors, perhaps not surprisingly, differ dramatically from those provided by school districts. Prior to contracting out, each of the districts we studied offered retirement benefits under the State of Oregon's Public Employee Retirement System with a 6% contribution of a worker's salary and usually some additional employer contribution or match. Contractors typically offer 401k plans that feature much lower employer contributions. For example, Mid-Columbia matches an employee's contribution up to a maximum of 4% a year. And there's a clear element of contingency built into these 401k plans offered by contractors. For example, the Sodexo company notes the company may, those are my italics, contribute to your plan each year, and the company reserves the right to make a contribution to the savings plan. So under the 401k types of plans offered by private contractors, there's no guarantee that the employer contribution will be provided or maintained. And indeed, with the reduced wages and benefits that often accompany private contracting, it's not surprised that many workers elect not to contribute to their 401k plans. And the workers we surveyed in Lincoln County, for example, who are now working for private contractors, only half chose to contribute to their 401k plans. So given the limited resources that contractors put into the 401ks and the diminished likelihood that employees can sustain their contributions, workers whose jobs have been contracted out appear to face the prospect of a less secure retirement than was previously the case. Contracting out also can have a community impact, and this can be illustrated by the experience of custodial workers in Lincoln County. Under the reduced wages provided by the district's first private contractor, we calculated that this group of 35 workers would pay an annual total of $24,000 less in state income taxes. And there's also a negative multiplier effect on the local economy that accompanies diminished wages. We estimated that the decreased wages paid by the contractor to Lincoln County custodians resulted in a negative multiplier of over $308,000 less being spent in the local economy. And for a coastal region where the school district is the county's second largest employer and job creation has shifted markedly toward the lower paying service sector, the loss of $308,000 is by no means insignificant and should be considered as an unintended consequence of contracting out. Clearly, school districts can reap considerable savings in labor costs when they contract out support services. However, our research suggests that contracting out presents hidden costs when it comes to the security and well-being of workers, families, and communities. Workers will have less purchasing power, and in smaller communities, as I just mentioned, where school districts are major employers, diminished wages can even have an effect on the health of the local economy. Contracting out may especially affect women, particularly in cases where they are heads of households whose jobs support a family, and we certainly have some anecdotal evidence that that is the case. And also, reduced health care benefits may lead workers to go without needed prescription drugs, to forego recommended treatments, to avoid doctor visits when they are sick. Each of these circumstances can result in costlier health care when taxpayers are forced or when ultimately the taxpayers will pick up the tab. In conclusion, let me just say that these are the kinds of costs which the proposed legislation before you today is asking you to take into account. If we believe it is sound public policy to promote the creation and retention of family wage jobs, contracting out as currently practiced would appear to undercut this important social priority. In order for workers and their families to be self-reliant and self-supporting, a family wage job is essential, and the evidence clearly suggests that these kinds of jobs are diminished when school districts turn them over to private contractors. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today, and we'll be glad to answer any questions you
Thanks.
Have. Thank you.
Ms. Smith, I have you down for 10 minutes. Do you need all
no,
that?
I don't have to.
Thank you.
I have Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. For the record, my name is Zakia Smith. I am an accounting technician at El Camino Community College in California, also the president of our Classified Employees Local, a vice president of the California Federation of Teachers, and a member of the Public Policy Committee for the American Federation of Teachers. California Federation of Teachers, and especially the American Federation of Teachers and myself, felt it important enough for me to come today and fly up from California to support this bill. In 2002, the California State Assembly passed Senate Bill 1419, which establishes that K-12 community college districts meet certain standards before contracting out classified employee positions. The California legislation provides that school districts comply with the same protections and provisions that apply to the California state government when contracting out personal services. You're going to hear more about what the House Bill 2754 says and all of that. I just want you to understand that the Oregon legislation is modeled very closely on California's statute. And attached to my written statement is our Senate Bill 1419 and also the 10 guidelines in this bill and a list of services that can be contracted out without having to meet those 10 guidelines. I'm just going to give you, in my written statement, I have several examples of what have happened in California. I'll just touch on a few. San Diego Unified School District partially contracted out their bus services to Laidlaw, a name that you've already heard. And during this time, there were 10 or more incidents of failure by the contractor's buses than by the district's buses. Also, the district reported 3 school bus accidents while traveling 662,000 miles versus 8 school bus accidents reported by the contractor while traveling less than 500,000 miles. Ultimately, the bus services were brought back in-house, and they were able to do that because they only partially contracted out their bus services. In Orange Coast Community College District, they contracted out their bookstore to Barnes & Noble, which resulted in higher book costs and less services to the students. El Camino Community College District, Compton Center. Compton just recently became part of El Camino College District. Previously, they were the Compton Community College District, and they contracted out their bookstore also to Barnes & Noble. Barnes & Noble increased their book costs and limited their hours of operation. The bookstore would open only a few days at the beginning of each semester. And what typically happens with companies like Barnes & Noble, they'll come in and they'll pay the district for their bookstore inventory and then increase the book costs and lessen store hours. And once the inventory is gone and profits are no longer high enough, contractors will not renew their contract and districts are left scrambling to stock a bookstore for their students. Luckily for Compton, El Camino was able to foot the bill and in a 30-day period have a bookstore fully stocked and ready for their students at the beginning of this spring semester. Also in California and at the LA Community College District, they contracted with the Sheriff's Department in order to save money. They're now experiencing costs that are almost double what they paid for their own police department. Long Beach City College contracted with the Long Beach Police Department and has one sworn officer on duty at a time. All the rest are security guards. And these are just a few examples of what's happening when districts contract out work being performed by school employees. The levels of quality service and safety are questioned when work is being performed by outside contractors. The questions also arise, is this truly cost savings or is it just cost shifting? If a school district is not in control of who is being hired, then the school district will not be in control of the cost, level of service, and the safety of their staff, faculty, and students. By contracting out classified employee positions, contractors get away with shifting costs. Wealthy contractors pay lower wages and offer limited or no benefits. Low-paid workers with limited or no benefits will need to rely more heavily on public services. The taxpayers are the ones who end up paying for the contract employees' benefits, not the wealthy contractors. We have the basic belief that people deserve decent employment with decent benefits and that there be a safe and affordable educational system for all of our students. We believe SB 14, Senate Bill 1419, accomplishes this and that House Bill 2754 can do the same here in Oregon. And I ask that the committee support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Before I open it up to questions, there was some real nice people who couldn't come and testify in opposition to this bill today. Shared some concerns with me about the constitutionality of this. Does anybody out there at this panel want to address those concerns? Have you heard any concerns like that?
Mr. Chair.
All right, Mr. Wagner, we have a chance.
We're going to have another public hearing on this.
Yes.
I can address that.
Thank you. All right. Any questions for this panel then? And thank you for coming so far. I'm sorry you had to wait so long.
Oh, that's okay.
A lot to do today.
My flight's not till 8.
Great. Thank you. Have a safe trip home. Thank you very much. All righty then. I'm going to call Rob Wagner. And for the record, that's who was speaking to me off the camera here. Mark Schwebke and Duke Shepard, please.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to forego with the shortness of the hour here. I have an opportunity to testify in the future, but
absolutely,
perhaps we can bring one of our members up who took time off work today to share their perspective as well.
Yeah, I have them on the next bunch of folks.
Thanks.
Thank you. Go ahead, guys. Whoever wants to go first.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Schaffler and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify to your committee today. I'll be very brief. My name is Mark Schwebke. I'm president of the American Federation of Teachers of Oregon. We represent 12,000 Oregon workers in K-12, community college, and higher education faculty and classified positions, and child care workers in public and private sectors, as well as nurses and healthcare professionals in the private sector. I would like to start off and thank our partners in the effort from the Oregon School Employees Association. As others have already testified, HB 2754 sets standards for the use of personal service contracts performed by classified personnel. What is not included is the inclusion of community college classified personnel. I'm referring to public safety, custodial, secretarian, and administrative assistants here. AFT Oregon feels that the standards in HB 2754 should be extended to community colleges as well. Too often, school districts and community colleges use contracting out simply as a means to suppress wages and benefits and to avoid collective bargaining. A personal example I can relate to you is at Portland Community College, where I work. Some years ago, contracting out of public safety at certain workforce training centers resulted in complaints from students and staff and faculty about the lack of accessibility during night hours. On one campus, a private security firm was hired that doesn't provide on-campus presence. You literally have to call them like you were calling 911. If there are problems, students and staff have to call a number and eventually someone will show up. One of the primary crimes on campus at Portland Community College is sexual harassment of female students and staff while leaving classes or work at night. When PCC Public Safety was servicing these workforce training centers, officers were available who could escort those who felt unsafe to their cars. It is still an ongoing problem at PCC. Too often, contracting out is heralded as making the cost of classified services as competitive. At PCC, we're already using competitive measures via in-house systems and to make sure that their services we provide are on a par and in most cases superior to any comparable private sector entities. In conclusion, AFT Oregon would like to recommend that the committee include community college classified and support personnel into HB 2754. And also, we've got a couple of letters, one from our president of our classified local 3922 at Portland Community College and from our sister local at Hillsborough Public Schools in support of 2754. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, Duke Shepard, the Oregon AFL-CIO. I apologize, I don't have written testimony, and I will be exceedingly brief. I had the opportunity to testify the other morning in the Workforce Committee on a bill that was related to outsourcing of jobs overseas. And to a person across that panel, everyone was concerned about the idea of jobs going overseas chasing cheaper labor and cheaper standards. And I think if you look at national polls and the sort of the political environment in this country right now, that's certainly where the trend is going. Our suggestion would be that chasing cheaper labor and lower standards in state isn't acceptable either. And what we've heard today, that seems to be the case. When you hear about the contractors that were named in this testimony today, Sodexo, Laidlaw, these are not local innovators who came up with a better way to build a mousetrap. These are big companies. Somebody's making money on these deals. And we would submit that the people who do the work, who've been trusted to do the work in these school districts with our children, are the ones who should be making the money in exchange for their labor, rather than perhaps shipping it up the chain rather than where it's been. Thank you.
Go ahead, sir.
Representative Scheffler and representatives. My name is James Waters. I work for the Hillsborough High School as the head custodian. I've been there 12 years. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Hillsborough Classified United AFT Local 4671. When Sumner's Building Maintenance won the contract to replace the Hillsborough Public Schools custodians, they did so by replacing them with janitors. There is a difference. Janitors only clean, while custodians clean and do maintenance and repairs, such as changing light bulbs, patching holes, painting, plumbing, and so forth and so on. This was being done at night when the school was empty. Now it is being done by one custodian during the day when the school is occupied. This means that there are things that are not getting done. SBM told us that they had an endless supply of substitutes. Not true. Most high schools, middle schools, are short janitors every night. The turnover is high. I have only one of the original SBM employees after a year at my school. SBM pulls a lot of their substitutes from day labor centers in Washington County. They are dropped off at the school with no training on what to do, what to use, or how to clean the area. This makes me think, just what kind of background checks are they doing on the substitutes? When SBM was given the contract, they were also given a list of service standards. This list tells you what needs to happen daily, weekly, quarterly, annually, in the cafeteria, the kitchen, restrooms, gym, classrooms, and so forth. I do not think that 50% of that is being done. In fact, I know things on that list that have not been done as scheduled or have never been done at all. I consistently get complaints from the staff of the Hillsborough High School about the standards of service being received. When the district contracted our custodial jobs, they failed to account for the true cost of the decision. Employees who work for the school district are accountable to the students, parents, teachers, school boards who employ them. Contractors have no accountability to the education communities they serve. This has led to a situation where the services are not done or the district is forced to absorb costs anyways. Thank you for listening, and I appreciate your consideration of this important issue. I look forward to you to support this House Bill 2754.
Thank you. Committee, any questions, these gentlemen? Wait a second, guys. Hang on a second. Don't go anywhere.
I don't really have a question, more of a comment. I'm always have wondered about contracting out and how much is it really saving our school district. And I got to tell you, this testimony that they've given us today, I'm somewhat alarmed by some of the things that Mr. Lafer had to say, and I'm really concerned that some of that is flying in the face of our laws, and nothing's being done about it. That's really disturbing to me, and I think this committee should pursue that to some degree and see what we can do to see that these laws are upheld. And I got to tell you, this is really disturbing, and maybe it is time we take a serious look at this bill and implement some of these sorts of changes to prevent these kind of things from happening in the future.
Well, I will say this: I believe North Clackamas owns their buses. And I'm calling them tomorrow and telling them to keep them. Anyway, all right, that's enough of that. Calm down or I'll have to clear this committee room. I've always wanted to say that. Now you gave me the opportunity. All right, but I share some, if not all, of your sentiment. Okay, Chuck Bledsoe and Bob Baldwin, please. Yeah, I thought you were done. Yes, absolutely, Representative. Good luck on that.
Yeah.
Go ahead, gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler. My name is Bob Baldwin. I'm the president of the Lane Community College Employees Federation. I represent 650 classified staff at Lane Community College. There was a time not too long ago when if you were fortunate enough to have a job as the custodian or in the food services in your local school district, you had a middle-class standard of living. You could look forward to buying a house and putting your kids through college and retiring in some degree of dignity. That time is long since gone. Half my members, 49.7% of my full-time members, qualify for food stamps if they try to raise a family of four. What we're talking about here, the real issue of public policy, is how much poverty can we afford? We're in a race to the bottom. How low can we force the standard of living in Oregon in the name of trying to save a few dollars incrementally in some of our local budgets? And every time we lose one of my members out of what is arguably a close to family wage job, that's one more person who's going to be on food stamps, one more person who's going to be showing up at the emergency room because they cannot afford basic health care, and one more person whose old age is going to be financed by Medicaid. That's the life they're going to be living. Over 70% of my members are now in the 40-plus age group. These are not entry-level employees working while they develop a career. These are people trying to raise a family and move into retirement. And when we take away their job, these are not people who can go out, get a couple of years training, and move into a new career. We've devastated their life, and we've left them with virtually no capacity to go out and get a job, because who's going to hire somebody with a high school diploma that's 20 years old and virtually no job experience? They're going to be on a minimum wage standard of living. And they're just going to be one more statistic in the increasing poverty level and the increasing hunger level in Oregon. And that's the real public policy issue here, is how much poverty are we going to force through our own employees? Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Good day, House people. My name is Chuck Bledsoe. I'm the head custodian at Liberty High School in Hillsboro, Oregon. And I have been in the district for 16 years now. First topic is dirty schools, of course. Restrooms are not being cleaned properly, sometimes not at all. They using quite cheap chemicals to when they do clean the floors. These machine mopping, auto scrubbers, and that gets the main sections of the restrooms and stuff, but they don't go by back and mop underneath the urinals and toilets and stuff. In fact, the main person of SBM, the contracted supervisor, came to my school the other day, and we went through a walkthrough of the building. We went to the restroom of the main office area where the principal, you know, is at, and there was a ring in the toilet, and I says, "Is there a different way to clean toilet bowls than besides a brush?" And he says, "Well, no." And I says, "Well, since you guys have been here a year, I haven't seen one wet toilet bowl brush yet." And he says, "Oh." But anyway, a week later, a shipment of toilet bowl brushes came in. It had a box of 12 of them. There's one missing now. Also in the restrooms, there's things on the wall like blood and spit, and it, after a while, it makes a stench, and it never gets taken care of. Classrooms not being vacuumed, desks not being sanitized on a regular basis. Water fountains not being cleaned, and with that, mold and bacteria starts to grow. If basic cleaning is not getting done, how often do extra things like doorknobs, faucets, and drinking fountains get sanitized? Security. Doors of classrooms, computer classes are not locked during nighttime events, so the school's wide open for theft. Main office is locking their coffee nowadays because one of the SBM people was caught taking dry granules of coffee out of the coffee bin and putting it in theirs to take it back to the back room. So that's why that's being locked up. Outside gates aren't being locked. Equipment. Our propane buffer that we got 4 years ago was brand new, and now they're taking, since they own the property now, they're taking parts off of that and putting onto other propane buffers to keep them going instead of taking them in and getting them fixed properly. So with that, equipment's being lost and not being replaced. Mops and brooms are being left outside in the reach of students and the general public, which the kids, when they get a hold of that stuff, they go around and poke the ceiling tiles up in the hallways, break windows, what have you. Communications. Basic communication barriers have been made ineffective. Having a subcontractor creates an instant communications barrier for staff. With my conclusion, as head custodian of my high school, we went from having a short staff which was dedicated to keeping a clean, secure, and sanitary environment to an even smaller staff whose only concern is sweeping floors and emptying garbage cans. This scenario is happening over 30 schools in our district to balance a budget that the state funding has created. Our kids' health are at risk. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for these gentlemen? All righty then. Thank you very much. Well, this goes also wraps around a broader conversation of how we and at what level we fund education and the good people that provide that here in the state. And there's a lot goes into that, a cultural shift against workers and unions. In my humble opinion, are wrapping up the abundant resources of this state so we can't take advantage of them. I think we can get some money there. But this conversation is going to go on, and we'll probably have another public hearing on there. There's a lot in this bill. Some of the things that are in this bill will be addressed with other bills as well that we are going to be hearing soon as well. So,
Mr. Chair, yes, sir, can I? Thank you. And I just wanted to really thank everybody who came forward and testified today, because I think this is a huge problem, and the situation that I'm most familiar with took place in Portland, you know, and I think people are very familiar with that, where the school district, despite a huge amount of opposition from the community, did contract out the custodial services, and in the end, it was a disaster, did not save money. They had failed to take into account, for instance, the unemployment insurance costs when they calculated what it would save. And in the end, the courts basically said, you can't do it anyway. So now they've had to go back and rehire those employees that lost their jobs. And so the costs, not just to the schools, the children, the community, are, I think, often not taken into account. So I really appreciate everybody who came forward and brought this to our attention.
Yeah, we didn't even hear about that case today. Any other comments for the good of the order on this bill? Yes, sir. Come on up. Please keep it brief. I appreciate that. And identify
thank you,
yourself.
Chairman Schaffler, and members of the committee. My name is Stephen Arajo. I'm the executive director for the Oregon School Employees. I do not have a prepared statement. I'm just working off what through the testimony just given. I just want to bring us back to the actual core issue here, and that is the four-year research of the University of Oregon's LIRC program, Professor Bussell and Lafer. I think what you heard is where the real crime is. It's not in complaining about the contracted worker or the workers that lost their jobs. It's about the agreements that are being made behind closed doors. It's about the help that our employers, meaning the school districts, need in having guidelines, if there's going to be privatization, what they need to go through to ensure that it's done correctly and properly, and doesn't do any damage to the community, the taxpayer, the children, or the workers in the community. So I appreciate Representative Hovey's statements and Representative Rosenbaum. Please, give this due consideration. The issue here is the actual agreements that in most cases are irreversible, and it just means more and more loss of taxpayers' dollars, and that the state itself is funding these private contractors who today pay, understand, at times a minimum of $10 in corporate tax and gives nothing back to the state but takes our money out of the state. Please help us with this issue. Thank you.
Well, we tried to do that earlier this session, too, and hopefully we'll take care of that one, too. Anyway, all righty then. Well, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2754. Thank you all for coming. Any other comments for the good of the order today? We're adjourned.